1 and 13. Brothers and sisters in the Dharma, friends, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome. On behalf of the organizing committee of Aloka House Sabha, I would like to extend a very warm welcome to our distinguished speaker for this evening, Venerable Achan Brahmawamso. Achan Brahmawamso is also affectionately known as Achan Brahm. We are indeed very happy, honored, and fortunate that Achan is here with us in Kota Kinabalu Sabah to share his wisdom in the Buddha Dharma. For this, we have to thank our sister Tabika and sister Lee Suhua from the Kuching Dharma Vijaya Buddhist Center for helping us to invite Achan to Kota Kinabalu. Thank you, sisters. So without taking any more time, I now humbly invite Achan Brahm to commence his talk on finding the true meaning of life by leading us in the Buddha Vandana. Achan, please may you. Thank you.
Very good. So now, that's amazing. I haven't said anything yet. I already get a round of applause. This is very encouraging. So we'll do the Namo Tassa for those of you who want to join in. Those who don't know the words can just hum the tune. Here we go. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Very good. So, first of all, for those of you who aren't Buddhists, don't worry that during this talk I will be teaching things which hopefully will go across all the boundaries which separate human beings according to the religion. Indeed, I may begin by saying that the meaning of my name, Achan, is teacher, and the meaning of the second word, Brahm, it means B for Buddhist, R for Roman Catholic, A for Anglican, H for Hindu, and M for Muslim. So even at the very beginning, I hope you all feel welcome here. If there are any Jewish people in here, I do apologize. I couldn't fit you into my name. But nevertheless, I hope you all enjoy this evening's talk about the meaning of life. Now I'm going to start off with something I heard when I was at university. And because that in a place like Cambridge University, people are very intelligent but not very wise. And I remember one of my friends said life, this was his definition of life. And it's actually very accurate, but it's not very hopeful. He says, life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. And if you think about it, that's very accurate. But there must be more to it than that. And so each one of us in our lives, that we go from day to day seeking that meaning, and seeking that fulfillment, seeking something which makes life more than a sexually transmitted terminal disease. And today I'm going to give you some indication of not just what that meaning is, but more importantly, how to find the meaning of life. So listen carefully. First of all, those of you who haven't heard me before, you will soon notice that many of the ways that I teach are through stories. And the reason I like teaching in stories, that those are very easy to remember, They keep people listening. It's a great way of getting people's attention. And also, they not just convey the meaning, but they convey it in a way which is very easy to remember. So the first story is where you can find the meaning of life. Now to begin, that's the story. I just have to explain a little bit about the life of a Buddhist monk in our tradition. From the time of the Buddha, the monks would live a very, very simple life with very few possessions. And in order to let go of their attachments, they'd usually leave their monastery and go wandering from place to place. In the time of the Buddha, they would walk. And today, you go on SQ or MH or maybe Air Asia. So I am a wandering monk of that tradition, but I don't walk these. I usually go in aircraft. But in the time of the Buddha, the monks would walk from place to place carrying their belongings with them, except when it came to the rainy season, the monsoon season, where the monks would stop and they would stay 3 months in one place. Now many, many years ago there was an old monk and he'd been wandering from place to place. And a couple of days before the retreat was about to start, he came to the house of a poor farmer for his alms food. The poor man was a Buddhist, so he gave this monk some food. And the farmer said to this monk, "Where are you going to stay for the retreat period?" And the monk said, "I don't know yet." And the farmer said, "Venerable sir, please come and stay with us. Even though I am poor, I can feed you. I will build a simple hut for you, not far away, where it's quiet and peaceful and you can meditate as much as you want. All I ask is every now and again, please teach me something about Buddhism, about life, about meditation. That's all I ask." And the monk said, "Okay." So for 3 months, the whole family looked after this monk. And the monk taught the family many, many wonderful teachings. So much so that the husband learned not to argue with the wife. And the wife never argued with the husband. You know how to do that? It's very simple. You know the reason why we were given 2 ears? One is to go in, one is to go out. So when your husband is talking, if you don't like it, let it out the other side. You don't have to keep it. Same with your wife. Only keep the good stuff. The secret of a happy marriage is learning how to be deaf. But he gave them all sorts of much deeper teachings than that. And after 3 months, they got to love that old monk. Even the children learned so much wisdom from that old monk that by the end of the 3 months, when the old monk said, "My retreat is over and it's time for me to go," the whole family started crying. "Please don't go, venerable sir. We love you so much. Even the dog will be unhappy if you go." And the old monk said, "I have to go, this is my tradition." "But," said the old monk, "in my meditation, it's been so deep. I have developed these powers and I have seen a hidden treasure very close by and I want you to have it. You've made such good karma, I want you to be rich. So you, your children, even your dog, I want him to have nice food from this day on." "But," said the old monk, "to find that treasure, you have to listen carefully and follow all my instructions." "Yes," they said. Because when money is involved, everybody pays attention. "So," he said, "tomorrow morning,
You must get up at dawn. You must stand at the threshold of your hut. That's the doorway. And then pick up your bow and arrow, which poor farmer had to use. And point the bow at the rising sun. When the sun comes up, let the arrow fly. And where the arrow falls, there you will find the treasure. A great treasure. And, said the old monk, I guarantee the treasure is there. Because old monks don't lie. And they don't. So the family was sad that their monk was going to go soon, but they were also so excited that in a day or two's time, I started a ghost story, so I might as well tell it. This is a true story, happened recently. I got a call about 2 months ago from a lady in Sri Lanka. Her brother had got very bad cancer. And they sent him to Singapore for the best treatment they could afford. Unfortunately, that nothing was working. Her brother was paralyzed and was dying. And she asked, can I please give her brother a call? He wanted to speak with me just to calm him down, to learn some good teachings just before he died and to answer many of his questions. So for 2 evenings I spoke to him, from Australia to Singapore to his hospital bed. The following night he died. And the night afterwards the sister called me. She said, he died last night. But I want to say a very strange thing happened this morning. He died the night before, but this morning he sent me an email. An email from beyond the grave. He was already dead. And he couldn't have sent it beforehand. He was paralyzed. And all he said was to say thank you to his sister for arranging the talks with me. I said, are you sure? Is there any other way it could have been delayed? He said, no. That was an email sent after he had died. Ooh. But I always wondered, what Gmail means. I now know it means ghost mail. It's Gmail. There's a true story. It happened. Anyway, back to the old monk. So the following morning, they were all up early. And there was the husband with his bow and arrow, standing, following the instructions, standing at the threshold of his house, waiting for the sun to come up. And being in Asia, he had his wife carry the spade to dig the hole. You know what husbands are like? You're in Asia, but don't worry. The law of karma will fix him in a moment. So, he was waiting, and as soon as the sun came up, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and they all ran after it, including the dog, and the poor wife. She had to do the digging. She dug a huge hole, and what did she find? Nothing, only trouble. Because that arrow landed in a field belonging to a rich man. He came along and he said, you can't do that. That's destroying my property. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to take everything you've got. And the poor wife said, it's his fault, pointing to the husband. And the husband said, no, it's this old monk's fault. He said we'll find a big treasure. And the rich man said, that's strange, because I'm a Buddhist too, and old monks don't lie. What did the old monk say? And when the husband told the story, the rich man said, oh, look at you, you're so weak and thin. You don't eat enough, you haven't got enough strength to shoot a bow and arrow. Look, said the rich man, I'll do a deal with you. Tomorrow I will shoot the arrow. I will split the treasure 50-50. That's how rich men make their money. But the poor farmer had no choice. So the following morning, it was the rich man with the bow and arrow. And because of law of karma in Buddhism, this time husband had to carry the spade. And when the sun rose, the rich man shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. It went much further because it was much stronger. And they all ran after it, including the dog. And they dug a big hole. This time the farmer had to dig the hole. And what did he find? Nothing, only more trouble. Because this time the arrow landed in a field belonging to a general. And the general was with his soldiers and saw them and told his soldiers, cut off their heads. And the husband says, not my fault, the rich man told me to dig this hole. And the rich man said, no, it's that old monk's fault. And the general said, old monk? I'm a Buddhist too, said the general. And old monks don't lie. What did the old monk tell you? And when they told the story, the general said, it's obvious where you've made a mistake. How do any of you know how to shoot a bow and arrow? You have to be in the military, a soldier. I've trained how to shoot. Look, said the general, tomorrow morning I will shoot the bow and arrow. And where it falls, I'm sure we'll find a treasure because old monks don't lie. We'll split it three ways. So that's what they did. The following morning, the general was at the threshold of the poor farmer's house, waiting for the sun to rise. And when it did, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And because he was a professional in the military, that arrow went a long way. And they all ran after it. And this time it was a rich man's job to dig the hole. See, what goes around comes around. So he dug and he dug, and what did he find? Nothing. Only more trouble. Because this time the arrow landed in the field belonging to the king. And the king arrested a lot of them. That's a capital punishment for destroying the king's property. So the king asked the general, what are you doing? And the general said, it's not my fault, it's the rich man's fault. The rich man, it's not my fault, it's the farmer's fault. The farmer said, it's that old monk's fault. And the king said, old monk? Because I'm a Buddhist too, said the king. And you know what the king said next? Old monks don't lie. There's something strange here, said the king. So said the king, I'm going to put you all in jail for a few days until I find that old monk and find out what's going on. So he sent his soldiers out in all directions, and soon they found that monk and they brought him back to the palace. And in front of the general, the rich man, the farmer and his wife, even the dog was in jail. Actually, it wasn't. I just made that up, but it sounds good. But anyway, in front of everybody, the king asked the old monk, you've got all these people into big trouble. Why? Because, said the old monk, they did not follow the instructions. What did you mean, said the king? Look, said the old monk, tomorrow you go to that poor farmer's house and you shoot the bow and arrow, your majesty. And I guarantee you, your majesty, that you will find a great treasure. And I ask you to split it four ways. And even you, your majesty, with your 1/4 share, will be very, very happy. Imagine how happy the poor farmer will feel. And so the king said, okay. And the following morning, the king was there at the threshold. And as he stood there, he looked at the old monk who was also there with the general, the rich man, the farmer, the wife and the dog. And the old monk said, correct, Your Majesty. And he picked up the bow and arrow and turned around to the monk. Correct, Your Majesty. And he waited for the sun to rise. And he faced the rising sun. Correct, Your Majesty, said the monk. And he was just about to shoot the arrow when the monk said, Wrong, Your Majesty. You're not following the instructions. What do you mean, old monk? Said the king. I told all these people, stand at the threshold of your house. Face the rising sun. Pick up the bow and arrow and let the arrow fly. I never said, shoot the arrow. I said, let it fly. And the king understood. He opened up his thumb and finger and the arrow fell right between his feet. And there the general, because it was his turn now, dug a very small hole. And there they found a huge treasure, enough to satisfy many kings. And so the family and the rich man, the general and the king, lived happily ever after. And the monk said, this is not just a worldly treasure you find. Too often we shoot the arrow of craving over there and over there. And what do we find? Nothing, only trouble. Because it usually belongs to somebody else. But if you let the arrow of craving, of wanting, drop, where does it fall? Right where you are. And there, in this present moment, in this body and mind, right here, in the seat you're sitting in right now, there you find a treasure beyond your wildest dreams. There you find the meaning of life. So that's a really nice story. So, those of you who are married, where will you find the most perfect husband? With the one who you're married to right now. He's perfect enough. Where do you find the most perfect wife? The one you have right now. You know why I say that? Because I've done lots of marriage counseling. I've been long years doing this. I found an important secret in life. All of you girls who think you want to change your husband, don't, because they're all the same. Girls also, you think I'll get rid of this one, get a newer model? No, maybe on the outside, the chassis is outside is more new, but the inside is exactly the same. So you might as well stick with the one you've got. And there you can find your happiness. You know about the young man? His father was so wealthy that his son didn't ever need to work. Not only that, he was really good looking. He was what they called in the West, drop dead gorgeous. He'd make Justin Bieber look ugly. He was so good looking. And he really well educated. He thought, I'm a great guy, so I want to marry the most perfect girl. So you know what he did? He went to Singapore to look for the most perfect girl. And he looked and looked and he found a really beautiful girl. And he went out with her a few times, but then he realized, no, he can't marry her. You know why? Because she couldn't cook. So what's the use of a wife if she can't cook? So he went to KL. And there in KL, he found a girl who was even more beautiful than the one in Singapore, and she had her own restaurant. She was a brilliant cook, but he couldn't marry her either. You know why? Because she was stupid. So then, where did he go to next? He came here, to Kota Kinabalu. And there, he met this woman. Oh, she was so beautiful. No, like she was like supermodel. And she had 5 restaurants. All Michelin star rated. She was a great cook. And she had PhD from Cambridge, another one from Harvard, and another one from University of Malaysia. 3 great PhDs. She was genius. And he went out with her for a couple of times too. But he couldn't marry her. You know why? Because she was looking for the perfect guy. So, you might as well enjoy the one you've got. This is one of my disciples in Singapore. She told me this, a true story. She said that when she got married, you know, her father took his new son-in-law aside to give his son-in-law some advice. He said, you know, to this woman's new husband, he said, "You probably love my daughter very, very much." And he said, "Oh, she's so beautiful. She's so charming. Even the way she picks her nose is so delightful." Because that's what it's like when you're in love. Everything they do is gorgeous. It's so cute. And the father said, "Yeah, that's what it's like when you first get married, when you're in love. But be careful. Because in about 1 or 2 years, maybe 3, maybe less, in a short time you'll begin to see the faults and defects in my daughter. You start to see the things which are wrong with her." "But," said the father, "please remember this. When you start to see my daughter's defects, remember this. If she didn't have those defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you." And it's true, isn't it? So every time you think your wife is not good enough, remember, if she didn't have those faults, she'd have chosen someone much better than you. So be happy that, you know, you both got your faults. So, to find that happiness, the meaning of life, you find it with what you've got, where you are, right here, right now. So right here, right now, in this moment, that's where the meaning of life lives. Because look, in all of the past, all that's happened to you, do you really remember that perfectly? What really happened? Or do you only remember part of the truth? A lot of times, you know what people do? There's an old story from my teacher Ajahn Chah. And this story I teach to all psychologists. And people who are actually practicing psychologists say this is one of the stories they use with every one of their clients. Because it works. For those of you who suffer from depression, guilt, or anger, please listen to this story. It's very, very helpful. It was a story of the 2 chicken farmers. There were 2 chicken farmers. The first chicken farmer got up early in the morning, took his basket, went into the chicken shed to collect the produce of the night before. But when he went into the shed, he filled the basket full of chicken poo. You know, the feces, those little balls of dung. And he put that in the basket. And he let the eggs rot in the shed. he brought the chicken poo, the chicken dung, back into the house, where it made a big smell in the whole house, and his family were not very happy with him. Chicken farmer number two took the basket into the shed, and he filled the basket full of eggs. He left the chicken poo in the shed to rot. It does become valuable fertilizer later, but you don't bring it into the house with you. He brought the eggs back into the house so he could make an omelette for his family's breakfast and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. He was a wise chicken farmer. Now the meaning of this story is this. When you collect the produce of your life, when you remember what's happened in the last week, or just even today, what do you choose to put in your basket and bring home with you into the present moment? Do you collect the chicken poo or the chicken eggs? And a lot of people collect the poo. Oh, my boss told me off today. Oh, I scratched the car. Oh, someone argued with me today. Why is it we only remember the bad things of life? Instead, we should remember the beautiful things of life. Collect the eggs and let the dung rot in the past. A good example of this. Have you got photo album at home? I've been to people's houses. They have photos on the wall. They have photo of their marriage. They have photo of their children on holiday overseas. They have photo of their graduation. I've never seen anyone have a photograph of their divorce. I've never seen any photographs of them going to work on a Monday morning, stuck in the traffic. I've never seen a photograph of them in hospital. We don't keep unpleasant photographs, do we? We only keep the happy ones. Because when we look at them, they inspire us, they give us energy, they make us more motivated. But there's another photo album we've got between our ears. It's called our memory. So why do you always remember the bad things? The bad photographs. The photograph of when your wife shouted at you or hit you. Why do you keep those photographs? Drop them. Keep the nice photograph of when your wife gave you a big hug and kiss. Lovely, darling. Keep those photographs. Throw the other ones away. All you young people, instead of keeping the photograph of when your girlfriend dumped you, keep the nice photographs of when you found a nice new boyfriend. If you keep the good photographs, in other words, the positive experiences of your life, and you let the negative ones go, you will find you will not be one of these people who gets depressed or gets angry or guilty. You will find you are a happy person. And you will find you're a person who learns from the successes of life and stops trying to learn from the mistakes. You will find in life, and I teach this to business conferences, you'll find that you learn much more from successes in life and in business than you ever learn from mistakes. Look, in business, something goes wrong in the office or in your business, and it really makes you depressed. It stops you being motivated. You can't work very hard. You're discouraged. Instead, if we remember what works, the product which sold well and why it sold well, learn from the successes. And then not only have you got more motivation, more energy, you can work harder, you'll find you'll repeat successes. Don't try and learn from mistakes, let them go. Learn from successes instead. And if you do that, at least you'll know how to find the meaning from the past. And as for the future, who knows what's going to happen in the future? It's amazing how many people get afraid of the future. They think terrible things are going to happen. I've been alive 60 years now. So many times the end of the world was supposed to happen and it never did. 1996 was according to Nostradamus, 2000 Y2K. There was this fellow in the United States who said it was going to be April the 23rd and then it delayed to October the 23rd. Nothing happened. I was giving a retreat over in Phuket and they said a tsunami's coming tomorrow. It never came. So please, if anybody does come along and they say they are certain, if someone comes and tells me, yes, Ajahn Brahm, I'm absolutely certain the world is going to end in 2012, call a lawyer and make a bet. 100,000 ringgit says the world is not going to end. And I'll put that, my monastery in Australia, I'll put my monastery in Australia as collateral, $100,000. And you come along, $100,000, you say the world doesn't end. So if the world ends, I lose 100,000. If the world doesn't end, he loses 100,000. Of course, I can't lose, can I? If the world ends, I'm not around here to pay. But please don't be afraid, because the future, who knows what the future is going to be? You don't find meaning in the future. You only find it now. A lot of times, people that want to predict the future. Once. You know that monks do have psychic powers. So sometimes they come and see a monk and they ask, 4 numbers, please. We can't do that. But once, and only once, I saw my teacher, Ajahn Chah, tell someone's fortune. Because this man was a very, very clever man. He came up to my teacher and said, can you please read the lines on my palm and tell me my future? And Ajahn Chah said, no, I can't do that. Good monks don't do that. And the man said he was ready for that answer. He knew Ajahn Chah, good monks would say that. So he said to my teacher, he said, last week you gave a talk on gratitude. I've been serving you all these years, giving you food, giving you donations, driving you around, and it's the first time I ask for anything. Come on, show some gratitude and read the lines on my palm. So Ajahn Chah had no choice. He said, okay, give me your hand. And this is the first and only time this great monk was going to read a person's future. And so he took the palm and very, very slowly with his finger, he started to trace the lines on his palm. And every few seconds he'd stop and say, that looks good. Don't know about that. And this poor man was getting more and more excited. Because he knew Ajahn Chah, he was an old monk, and old monks don't lie. He knew whatever Ajahn Chah said would have to come true. And when Ajahn Chah was finally finished, this man said, yes, what's my future going to be? And very slowly Ajahn Chah said, this is going to be your future. Yes, what is it? And what I say is going to be 100% true. Yes, 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 what is it? And Ajahn Chah said, "Sir, your future, according to the lines on your palm, is uncertain." Never try to outwit an old monk. And that's so true. Your future is totally uncertain. Which means, whatever you want to do, you can do it. Now that was an amazing thing for me to understand. Anyone really young here, whatever you want to do in life, all the doors are open to you. Some doors are heavier, they take more effort to push open. But you can push them open. Because the future is being created by you in every moment. You make the world. And I realized that a long time ago. So if you want to make a good world or a bad world, it's totally in your power. That's one of the meanings of the laws of karma. It's not fate. It's not predestined. It's up to you to make the future. And I think if the whole world could understand that much, that we can make the future, that we are not bound by fate. It doesn't have to be this way. And if we took to heart charge with the hope that that teaching gives us, it's amazing what we can achieve and what we can do. So, meaning of life is not with the future. It's with this present moment. Because look, where is your future being made? When is the only time you can do anything about your future? Right now, in this moment, your future health, happiness, and prosperity is being made right now. And if you keep worrying about the future, what you're doing, you're neglecting this present moment where the future is being made. That's why things go wrong. So for me, I don't worry about the future. Another story. Long time ago, there was a king, and he was out hunting, as kings used to do in those days. And as he was out hunting, he cut his finger on a branch of a tree, and he called the doctor over, because the doctor was on the hunt with the king. "Please look at my finger," said the king. And the doctor looked at it. "Is it going to be okay?" said the king. You know what the doctor said? "Good, bad, who knows?" There's a few doctors here. Do you ever say that to your... Where are you? My driver's today. Do you say that to your patients when they come and say, "Now how is it?" You say, "Good, bad, who knows?" But anyway, he put a band-aid on the wound and carried on hunting. When the king got back to the palace, you know, the wound was actually infected. It all swollen up and got red. And so the king said, "Doctor, come and look at this. It's got worse." He said, "Yeah, it has got worse." So the doctor took the band-aid off, cleaned up the wound, put some ointment on, and put a proper bandage on. And of course, the king said again, "Is it going to be okay now?" And the doctor said, "Good, bad, who knows?" That's not reassuring. And true, a few days later, that wound was so badly infected, the doctor had to amputate the finger. And the king was so upset, he threw the doctor in jail. He locked the door of the cell himself and said, "You stupid doctor, all this good, bad, who knows business. No, you're supposed to know, you're a doctor. I'm throwing you in jail. What do you think of being in jail?" You know what the doctor said when he asked what it was like in jail? He said, "Good, bad, who knows?" Have you ever been to jail? Have you ever seen any prisoners? You know, what do you feel like being in jail? Good, bad, who knows? That was a crazy doctor. But anyway, the wound soon healed. And a few days later, the king was off hunting again. And he was following some animal in the jungle. And he got separated from the rest of his party. And then he got totally lost in the forest. He didn't know where he was. And wandering around, he got captured by the indigenous tribes. And the indigenous, you know, the people who've been in the forest for a long time, the forest people, it happened to be one of their holy days. And they were looking for a sacrifice. And now they'd found one. So they took that king, tied him to a tree, and their priest started dancing around and chanting, waka boka boka, or something like that. And when the chanting got to its peak and they were about to slit his throat as a sacrifice, someone in the audience said, stop! That man has only got 9 fingers. He's not perfect. He can't be sacrificed to our God. Because you can only sacrifice perfect things to such a God in the jungle. So they had to let him free. And as he walked back and found his way back to the palace, he realized that losing his finger had saved his life. The doctor was right after all. When you lose a finger, you think it's bad. But it could be good. Who knows? It might save your life. So, as soon as he got back to the palace, he went to the dungeons and let the doctor free. He said, I'm so sorry. I didn't understand how wise you were. I thought it was bad, but actually losing the finger saved my life. And I feel so guilty. It's a terrible thing I did, throwing you in jail when you actually saved my life. You know what the doctor said? Throwing me in jail was bad. It wasn't bad. It was good. How come? Said the king. He said, well, look, Your Majesty, if you hadn't put me in jail, I would have been with you on the hunt. I'd have been captured, and I've got my 10 fingers. So, good, bad, who knows? The future is uncertain. So, if you lose your job, good, bad, who knows? This is a true story. I told that story in Jakarta a couple of years ago. And the fellow who was looking after me said, that's so true, because his boss called him into the office about 5 or 6 years ago and literally took a gun out from the desk and put it to this man's head, resign or I'll shoot you. That's tough businessman. Really tough. And of course, he had no choice. He actually resigned, and he didn't know what to do, to call the police or whatever, but he resigned from his job. He had a wife and young children out of a job. But because he was out of the job, the only thing he could do was to use his contacts and his experience to start his own company. And now he's a millionaire. And so he said, at the time, he thought it was so bad. But actually it was good. It made him the successful businessman he is today. Look at me. You know, when I was about 19, true story, when I was 19, I fell in love. I fell in love with a beautiful girl over in England. You know what? She dumped me. Was that bad? No, it was good. That's why I could become a monk. So. So if your girlfriend dumps you for another boy, oh, very, very good. You could become a monk too. So the future in life, we don't know what's going to happen. So when everything... Whenever anything like that happens in life, Remember, good, bad, who knows? You know, Steve Jobs, he was a Buddhist. And Steve Jobs, you know, he got sacked from Apple. And he says that was the best thing which ever happened to him. To understand his passion for life. So a lot of times we do also find meaning in life in the bad things which happen to us. Well, we think they're bad, but what they really do, they give us or they remind us what the real meaning of life is. So when, you know, something goes wrong in your life, there you will find immense meaning. Number one, you find you can make whatever you want out of this. Sometimes, if you tread in the dog poo. Do you have dogs being walked in Kota Kinabalu on the street? Do you sometimes tread in the dog poo in your shoes? If you do, don't scrape it off your shoes. Not yet anyway. Bring it home with you. And scrape it off in the garden. Under the mango tree. Do you have durian in KK? Do you like durian? Scrape it off under the durian tree. And 1 year later, your durian will be more delicious than ever before. It will, because dog poo is fertilizer. But the thing is, when you're eating that succulent durian, you must remember what you're really eating. It's dog poo, but it's turned into delicious durian. That's how it works. So what you thought might have been unpleasant, if you know how to use it, it can make you the beautiful, wonderful person you are. The kindness, the compassion, the love, that's where you learn it from. So the meaning of life is often found in the most difficult times which you have to face as a human being. Not in the happy times, but in the difficult ones. And there you can find what the true meaning of life is. You know what it's like when people are sick? Or when you have been sick? Have you all been sick here? Is there anybody here? Please put your hand up if you've never been sick in your whole life. Please put your hand up. Anyone here has never been sick? So, well, actually, if someone did put their hand up, they'd never been sick, you'd be really weird. You'd be so strange that the doctors would actually take you to university, do experiments on you. There would be something actually quite wrong with you. So it is natural to be sick. It is okay to be sick. It's actually right to be sick. So why is it when you go to a doctor, you say, there's something wrong with me, I'm sick. Never say that. Next time you are sick, go to your doctor and say, doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. What's wrong with being sick? Now when you are sick, don't feel guilty about it. You're giving all of your friends and relations, you're giving opportunity for them to make good karma. It's really important. So you can say, darling, look, I can't cook for you today. You have to cook for me. You have to do the washing up. You have to do the shopping. It's time for you to do good karma. And all these people come and visit you. It's so nice, isn't it, to actually to see people when they come and visit you? Why can't they come and visit you when you're healthy? You can enjoy it more. So there's something very wonderful about being sick. So when you are sick, number one, you don't have to go to work. You can relax. No stress. Relax. So there's a lot of advantages and good things about being sick. So, if you can remember that, It means even in sickness you can find meaning. Your meaning is your encouraging other people to be compassionate. How can we practice compassion if we've got no one to practice on? So every now and again, interns volunteer, okay, I'll be sick today. So you can practice your compassion on me. And so everyone enjoys that. So we all take turns in life. So there's nothing wrong or bad. So even in sickness, we can find deep meaning. The trouble is, though, have you ever found that we become sick at the most unfortunate times? And I was giving a talk once, this was in KL. And I don't know what someone gave me to eat. But oh, my stomach was turning. I wanted to be sick. And in the end I said, I got to go to the toilet, but I never made it. I was sick on me. But it's such a wonderful thing to do. That was my teaching that evening. Even monks get sick. So what we're talking about there is that even in sickness there is a deep meaning. And of course, most of all, even in death there's a beautiful meaning in death. I don't know why it is that people are afraid of death. If you're a Christian, aren't you going to go to heaven when you die? Bring it on, as George Bush used to say. Why do you want to waste the... Those of you who believe like a Buddhist in the Pure Land, don't you go to the Pure Land? Starbucks is a very nice state, but it's not quite as nice as the Pure Land, is it? Or if you want to go to a heaven, well, look. In Australia, some years ago, there was an old couple. This old man, old woman. They'd been married for 50, 60 years. Really good people, devoted to each other. And when the husband, I think the wife died, the husband died a few days later. I've seen that many, many times. You know, when one dies, they're so close together, the other one loses the will to live and they die. So anyway, they died within days of each other, so they appeared in heaven together. And they were met in heaven by this angel. And the angel said, because of all of your goodness, I've come to show you your reward, your heavenly reward. And they took them to this amazing, wonderful mansion with what they call million-dollar views. And the angel said, that this is yours because of all the wonderful, kind, good, generous things you've done in your life. Enjoy it. And the husband, he had to work so hard in his life to pay all the bills. So he actually turned around to the angel and said, look, this is a big house. I don't think I can afford the government taxes. Do you have to pay government taxes on big houses in Sabah? Yeah. Bigger the house, the bigger the tax. Is that right? Yes. He said, I can't afford this. Give me a small one. And the angel said, there is no government up in heaven. No taxes. It's free. Did you know that? No tax in heaven. So, the angel then took them inside. And you know they had to have a GPS to actually to find the way inside such a big mansion. And every room had different types of furnishings. They had beautiful furnishings from Europe, great furnishings from Australia, exquisite furnishings from Sabah. They had these huge chandeliers with diamonds. They had this big 50-foot wide plasma screen TV. Huge. And he said, you know, the husband always liked to watch, you know, the soccer from England. He said, when your soccer team plays, because this is heaven, they always win. It's heaven. And he took them to even the toilet. The toilet was a gold, solid gold bowl. And the little button you press was a ruby. And when you pressed it, not water came out, but Chanel number 5. It was heaven. And the man said, look, this is such expensive stuff. There's so many. Look, I'll have to pay big insurance on all of this. The insurance premium will be more than I can afford. I said, what do you want to pay insurance for? There's no burglars allowed up in heaven. It's all for free. Enjoy it. And then he took them down to the garage. Not a double garage. Triple bay garage. And the first car was this four-wheel drive vehicle. Huge. And it could go anywhere. It could go cross-country, up Mount Kinabalu easy. It was so strong, could even go up waterfall. And the second car was one of these stretch limousines like you see in Hollywood. But that was really big. It was so big it had a swimming pool in the back. And the third car was a Ferrari. A limited edition, specially made red Ferrari sports car. And you know, like many men when they get above 50, they always dream of sports cars. But he said, what's the point of having a sports car in the traffic? And even if you do go out early in the morning in Kota Kinabalu when there's no traffic around, you've got the policeman. Do they have speed cameras here? Yeah, they always catch you speeding. And he said, what's the point? And the heavenly being said, look, number one, no traffic in heaven. Number two, no policemen. We don't need to have speed limit. If you have an accident, you're already dead. So it doesn't matter. So, go as fast as you like. So then, they open the doors of the garage. And on the opposite side of the road was an 18-hole golf course. And the angel said, sir, we knew how much you enjoyed playing golf when you were fit and healthy. So for your heavenly reward, we've managed to build an immaculate 18-hole golf course on the opposite side from your mansion. He said, this golf course was designed by Tiger Woods himself. Do you remember when he hit that tree when he was being chased by his wife? He had near-death experience. He left his body, and during those few moments he designed your golf course. And he said, in the golf courses up in heaven, once you get the ball on the green, whichever way you putt it, it always goes in the hole. So the man said, look, that is one of these very, very high-class country club golf courses. I don't know any important people. I would never get elected as a member. And even if I do, I would never be able to afford the annual fee you have to pay. And the angel said, sir, there's no fees. You're already a member. Not a life member, a death member. And enjoy. So, at that the angel left him to his beautiful mansion, big TV, gold toilet with Chanel number 5, and Ferrari car and golf course. And as soon as the angel left him, the man got very angry. Really, really angry at his wife. He started shouting at her and scolding her. And he couldn't figure out why, or she couldn't figure out why. And when he paused for breath, she said, why are you angry at me, darling? You've got this beautiful mansion and your Ferrari car. I know how much you wanted one of those cars. And you can drive as fast as you like. And you've got your golf course. Why are you so upset at me? And he looked at her. Just, you know, with his Adolf Hitler look. He said, wife. Wife. Wife, if it wasn't for all that healthy food you gave me in the last few years, I could have been up here many years ago. So why are you afraid of dying? So you see, in death, we find the meaning of life. Because when you're dead, this is interesting. I've gone to so many funerals, because that's part of my job, to take funeral services for people. So many funeral services that people talk about the person who's died. And there you've got what I call the bottom line of a person's life. Just like when you do the accounts for the end of the year. They never talk about how much money that person made in their life. Nor do they talk about how big their house was. Nor do they talk about how high in their career they managed to reach. When a person dies, there you find the meaning of life. They talk about how kind they were, how generous, how loving, what a good friend they were, how they were always there for you to help, to serve, to look after you, what a great father they were, and how much you cared and loved for them. That is called the bottom line of a person's life. That is what you will be remembered for. That is what the meaning of life is. The amount of service, the amount of kindness, goodness, love, compassion, generosity which you have done in your life. There you will find meaning. Because in those acts of kindness, generosity, forgiveness, love, selfless service, there you will find meaning. Just where this arrow falls, there you find the meaning. That is where you find contentment. That is good karma. You take that to the limit, there you will find nirvana. But here you will find the peace, the freedom, the worth, the goodness, the beautiful karma, which is the meaning of life. So right here, not in the past, not in the future, right here, be kind. Right here, be peaceful. Forgive other people, no matter what they've ever done to you. It's their karma, not yours. It doesn't matter what a person's done. They've hurt you once. Every time you get angry at them, they're hurting you again. Let it go. It's their karma, not yours. Be kind. Be forgiving. Be peaceful. And there, you will know that this is the meaning of life. So there we have it. Very simple, with a few funny stories. Good, bad, who knows? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Thank you for listening. So now we have the fun part of the evening. We call it Q&A, questions and answers. To get the first question, I'd like to tell something from the Buddhist sutras. And this is from the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutra of the Majjhima Nikaya, teaching of the Buddha. It's a classic piece of Buddhism, but I usually get a few questions after this. Because once the Buddha was asked, about the law of karma. Why is it, that some people are wealthy while other people are poor? Some of you work really hard, you try your very best, and still it's very hard to make ends meet. While other people, they start a little business and they make heaps and heaps of money. It just comes to them. What karma do you have to do in this life to be rich in your next life? And so the Buddha gave an answer. It was so good, the man asked another question. And he said, why is it that some people are really beautiful while other people are ugly? What karma did they do in their past life to be ugly in this life? You may have noticed when I mentioned the word ugly, I looked at the floor. The reason is, when I mentioned this story in Singapore once, I just happened to be looking at one girl when I mentioned the word ugly, and she complained. Why did you say the word ugly when you were looking at me? It's even more difficult if I mention the word beautiful while I'm looking at someone. They get the wrong impression. But the Buddha gave the answer why some people are born ugly, while some people are born beautiful. The karma you have to do in this life to be beautiful in your next life. And it's such a good answer, the man asked another question. He said, why is it that some people, this is the important part, why is it that some people are born intelligent and other people just stupid? Now some people, you know, you go to school, you go to university, you don't have to work hard. You know, you can just play around. Actually, that was me. I didn't work hard, but still got top results. You know, you have really good degrees. While other people, they work hard, extra tuition, study long hours, and you still don't do well at school or university. What is the karmic cause for stupidity in your next life? And the Buddha gave the answer. The karmic, this is absolutely true, you can look it up. The karmic cause of stupidity in your next life is not asking questions in this life. Any questions?
I better ask one, Ajahn. I want to be smart next time. I've got a question here, Kelly, while the other people are settling down with their questions. How do we reconcile the worldly life and the spiritual life?
How do you reconcile worldly life and spiritual life? It's very easy. The spiritual life and the worldly life, they come together. Yes, you have to make money, but make money in a good way. In a way which doesn't exploit other people, because you may make lots of money, but it's unsustainable. And use that money for good purposes. So at the end of the life, you know that if you don't use it for good purposes now, we're doing charity work, you know, your kids will take it and they'll waste it. So you best actually to spend it wisely now. So it's going to really make the best use of all the money you have made. So even the worldly life and the spiritual life, and I'm being a bit serious now, that in my position these days, you do get to meet some very powerful people, presidents and prime ministers, people who run huge companies, but especially politicians. Because a few of them have come up to me and told me this. They say, in modern world politics, that many of the leaders of our great nations are just at their wits' end, trying to find some answer to the problems besetting the world. Whether it's wars, whether it's global financial crisis, you know, European debt crisis, whether it's the spread of sort of intolerance with people in the world, you know, global warming. Basically, they've tried everything they know and nothing works. And so really what they want to do, they're asking people of religion like myself, can you please give us some help? Can we please have more spirituality, you know, in the corridors of power? Because nothing else is working. So basically, even the leaders want to actually have the two united, as they should be. There should really be no difference between the spiritual and the worldly life. The two have to go together. You can't divorce them. When you do divorce them, that's where we get all the problems. You know, it's not just a business, it's people. It's not just great a city of Kota Kinabalu. It's just 800,000 human beings and other animals. People with hearts, people with tear ducts who cry. It's human beings. It's not sort of countries. It's a whole world. As Desmond Tutu kept on saying, so this is our only home. And if this one stinks, we all go down. It doesn't matter what religion or what race or what age you are, what species you are. And they want some spirituality coming back into our world. And I think it's so important. It's not a case of how do we reconcile. We have to reconcile them, to bring them two together. So it's not just going to work to make money. It's not just the economy. It's the humanity. That's why, you know, we call it gross national product, because it is gross. So we have a subtle national product, which is the harmony, the health of human beings. So anyway, that's Quick answer.
Thank you.
So I saw you got many other questions there.
Yeah, I got a number of questions relating to karma.
Very good.
So the first one asked, is everything that happens in life the consequence of previous karma? Are there no spontaneous events?
Yes, of course there are spontaneous events, but you can look upon it in another way. And once I was with my teacher Ajahn Chah, when a young man came, he'd been drafted into the Thai army and he'd been shot and badly wounded. And he came to see Ajahn Chah and said, is this my karma? Or rather, what karma did I do to get wounded? And Ajahn Chah said, it's obvious. It's the karma of joining the army. If you join the army, some people are going to get wounded. You should have looked it up on that little form you signed before you joined. He said, that's just the same of joining the human race. If you join the human race, you can be injured and die of many, many different things. Floods, earthquakes, tsunamis, traffic accidents. So don't look upon it as like one-to-one karma. I had to die in 9/11 because I must have done something bad to someone else in the past. No, it's because you're a human being. Becoming a human being, part of being a human being is you can die from so many, many different causes. So we accept that. We try and live with that. Being a human being is being vulnerable. That's part of being a human being. We can remember that every day, that our life is very delicate. We could die at any time. We can remember the simile of the cup. Ajahn Chah used to hold up a glass, not actually a cup, I haven't got a glass, this will do though. And he asked me, can you see the crack in my glass? And I looked, and I can't see any crack. He said, yes, because it's microscopic. But he said, it's there, because one day someone will drop the cup, the crack will open up, and it will break. It will be no more. It's anicca, impermanent. And he said, if it was plastic, it wouldn't have no crack in it. You could drop it, you could kick it, you wouldn't need to care, because it would be permanent. Just like human beings. Each one of you, including me, has got a crack in it. One day that crack will open up, I will die. But because I am fragile, vulnerable, subject to sickness and death, that's why I have to care. If I was immortal, I would not need to care. Impermanence, sickness and death teaches us the importance of kindness. Because the people you love and care for and live with are not going to be there forever. That's why we must care. Care big time. We don't know when they're going to leave us. So understanding, yes, we can die at any time. Yes, we can become sick at any time. And it's not just karma. Sometimes it is just many, many different causes. But the meaning of that is we must care. Come on.
Okay, there's a question from the back.
Good evening, Reverend. Something is biting my conscience for a long time. It's been biting. It's something to do with compassion and causing pain. Like mosquitoes. Because Buddhism says don't kill. But mosquito bites you and causes you extreme pain. Now what should I do?
Okay. So a mosquito bites you. Extreme pain, it's just a little irritation, but killing the mosquito causes much more pain to the mosquito than it causes to me. So I balance that. If you don't believe me, ask the mosquito.
But Reverend, you're carrying a baby. This mosquito comes to bite the baby. What should we do?
It's interesting, with a baby or with yourself, sometimes we keep thinking, oh, that I will get dengue, I will get malaria. Now actually the chances of you getting dengue or malaria from that one mosquito are so small. You're not going to get dengue, you're not going to get malaria for that mosquito. You're more likely to die in a car crash than that. But yeah, it irritates the baby. But then again, that you have to be very careful when you're looking after kids not to protect them over much. Because allowing them to play in the dirt, to actually to get bruised and cut, to get bitten by mosquitoes, actually increases their immune system. It makes them be able to endure what they have to endure later on in life when they grow up. It's a hard thing for especially a mother to allow her kid to hurt. But you have to do that because that's part of our life, to learn the meaning of pain, why we have pain, how to deal with pain. And a little mosquito is not that much. Look, there's hundreds of mosquitoes used to bite me when I was a young monk. You know, this was in Thailand. And look, this was no exaggeration. I went to some villages in Thailand where I was the first white man they'd seen, let alone a white monk. And that was not just human beings, that was mosquitoes as well. Because I'm sure they told all their friends, hey guys, there's Western food at this monastery. You know what it's like to get a new cuisine in KK. You'll want to go there just to try it out. So all these mosquitoes were there. And, you know, as a monk, they knew as soon as they saw brown robe, mosquitoes in Thailand had been genetically programmed to realize it was a safe dinner. And so they go all over you. And we didn't have mosquito nets, mosquito ointment or anything to keep them away from us. And so we would actually complain to our teacher, Ajahn Chah, can we have something to protect us from these mosquitoes? They're driving us crazy. And he gave this wonderful teaching. He said, from now on, the word Ajahn means teacher. From now on, you call these Ajahn mosquito. They're going to be your teacher. And my goodness, they taught me a lot. It's a tiny little bit of blood they take. There's plenty left for me. And yes, a little irritation. Just lasts a couple of seconds. It made me much tougher in life. I go to Singapore a lot, and in Singapore they have a draft. Every young man has to go in the army for a couple of years. And they were finding that as soon as they took these young men out to camp, they were complaining, there's no aircon in the tent. They're getting so soft that, you know, in the army you can't have an aircon in the tent when you're, you know, camping out somewhere in the jungles. You have to have some little bit of toughness to endure a little bit. So I think it's wonderful that we endure a little bit, because a lot of times when human beings, when we disturb the balance of nature and all these things which are called pests, we try and drive them out, we create more problems than it's worth. For some reason, mosquitoes have their place in the ecosystem. For some reason that, yes, they have to bite me, so I let them. So look, if they come to you, just say, Okay, maybe I'm not as advanced as Ajahn Brahm, go and see him. Or even the venerable in front over here. Send him to us.
Thank you. Ajahn, I'll try to read out three questions that are somehow related to karma. Maybe the first one said, it's difficult to turn the other cheek when someone treats you unkindly and say, it's dear karma. How do we practice this without feeling sick inside? Another question asks, what advice do you have in relation to anger management aside from the chicken story? Another one says, how do we reconcile the fact that many evil people seem to enjoy and get away with their bad deeds while those good-hearted people suffer and keep getting bad luck and even painful death? Thank you.
Okay, just with the law of karma, first of all, when someone treats you badly, what do you do? It's okay. It's first of all, I only allow people to treat me badly once. Many of you allow them to treat you badly many times. For example, somebody calls you a pig. And you think, why did they call me a pig? It's not right to call me a pig. They shouldn't call me a pig. And then you realize they've just called you a pig three more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you a pig again. So who is the stupid one? You are, for carrying it and remembering it. Someone was cruel to you in business. They cheated you. How many times did they cheat you? Every time you remember it, they're cheating you again. Which is why, when something bad happens, we learn to drop it straight away. If you can't find it difficult doing this, this is one of the other stories I've been telling psychologists. I went to a big psychology conference in Sydney a couple of months ago, in August. And I gave them this little method, because to be able to let go of the pain of the past is difficult to do. But there's certain things you have to do first of all. Number one is acknowledge it. You've got to bring it up to the surface. You can't hide it. You can't be in denial to the things which have happened to you, or which you've done which are wrong. So you have to write it down. So all the terrible things which have happened to you, the cruel things which people have done to you, write it down on a piece of paper. Carefully, neatly, completely. And the best piece of paper to use for this is called toilet paper. Because that associates all of that stuff which has happened to you with the normal things which go on toilet paper. It associates this thing as something which you shouldn't be keeping. So once you've written it all down on toilet paper, you read it again. And then in order to let it go, you take it to the place where toilet paper usually goes. The toilet bowl. Put it in the bottom and press the button. Bye-bye. Many people do that. We get many blocked toilets in Australia, but many free people. Because if you get angry, who are you getting angry at? Not them, yourself. Once upon a time, a long time ago, it's another classic story. There was a husband, who had the afternoon off work. And he was just hanging around his house when his wife said, who was cooking the dinner, said, "Oh, darling, I'm short of eggs. I need some more eggs for tonight's dinner. Would you mind going to the market and buying me some eggs?" He said, "Certainly, darling, I'll do that for you. But I've never been before. Can you please tell me what to do?" So she gave him the basket and some money and gave him directions. And off he went, happy to help his wife. It's the first time he'd been to the market. And as soon as he entered the market, this young boy, maybe about 18 or 19 years of age, came up to him and started abusing him. He said, "You're so ugly. You've got a face like a camel. The backside of a camel, that is. And I don't know what you use for your soap, but you smell of dog poo. Do you wash yourself in dog poo?" And he said even worse things than that, but I'm a good monk and I can't repeat them. But it was such bad words in public. And the husband didn't know this young man. He said, "What are you saying those things to me for? I don't even know you." But that just made this young man even worse. And really started scolding and shouting. And what he said to this husband in public, no one would want to hear. And the husband was so upset that he turned around and went home. And when he got into the house, he slammed the door. He was so upset, and the wife said, "Oh, you're home early, darling. Did you get the eggs?" "No, never step into that stupid market ever again. I don't want to ever go there. That's a terrible market. I don't know why people go there. It's just so horrible and really bad and so uncivilized." He was so upset. Now, as a monk, I'm always supposed to speak softly and coolly. So it's only when I give stories like this I can really enjoy myself. I enjoy telling this story. Anyway, when he calmed down a bit, then his wife said, "What happened, darling?" And then he told the story of him being abused by this young man. And his wife said, "Oh, it was him." He said, "That boy, his brain damaged. when he was young, he had an accident. He hit his head. And the poor boy would never be able to go to school. He can't find any work. He'll never find a wife to share his life with. He just stays in the marketplace. Sometimes he says worse things to me, worse things to other people. But we know that he's a crazy boy. Don't worry about him. And as soon as the husband realized he'd been abused by someone who was crazy, all his anger disappeared. And as soon as his wife saw that he was no longer angry, she said to him, "Darling, I still need those eggs." "Okay," he said, "and don't mind that crazy guy, yes." So he went back into the market. The boy saw him again. "Here comes Camel Face. Here comes that guy who used dog poo for soap." But it didn't matter anymore. How can you get angry when someone who's crazy is scolding you? He went to buy the eggs, and the woman selling the eggs said, "Don't mind him, he had a bad accident. He isn't a terrible tragedy. So young, we'll never be able to find a good life." And all the time, the husband was being abused. He never got angry once, because he realized it was a crazy man. And the moral of that story is this. If, when you go home, your wife starts scolding you, assume that she must have hit her head that morning and she's got temporary brain damage. Don't get angry at her. Because when people say bad things, it is temporary insanity. So just let them say it. They're crazy. They're mad. No people in their right mind will say bad things to others. So they say bad things to you. Oh, they're just crazy. And then you don't get angry. And the reason why that sometimes that people, you know, they do cruel things, and the people who receive that cruelty have a lot of suffering, is because they are the most stupid of the two. They're the ones who get angry and upset about being scolded. They're the ones who don't know how to let things go. That's why they sometimes die young and painful diseases. So when people are cruel to you, please let it go. It's their karma, nothing to do with you. They're just crazy. Let them do the crazy things. You be smart. And then you'll find that those people who do the crazy things, they will have the bad karmic results. And you will be peaceful and happy, live a long and happy life. That's what happens. And turning the other cheek is a Christian way of doing things. The Buddhist way of doing things is to run. Don't turn the other cheek, run like hell, or call the police or something. Okay, I think that's enough of those questions.
Then this pair of questions are related. The first question asked is, what is the use of Buddha statues? Can a successful meditation take place without them? And second question is, can a person reach enlightenment without meditation?
Okay, first of all, the use of Buddha statues. One of my friends as a monk was from Australia. He was visiting England. He was giving some talks there, but his host asked him, what did he want to see? And he was an Australian. He'd never been to Europe before. He wanted to see one of the castles. Because, you know, if ever you go to Europe, and that's what people go and see, the old buildings, the castles, and Tower of London. So they went to the castle, but they found it was closed. So they found, I said, what else can we go? And it's not so far away was the country house of Sir Winston Churchill, called Chartwell. Do you want to go and see that? So the monk said, okay. And as they went into the entranceway to pay the fee to go and have a look around the house where the British Prime Minister during the Second World War lived, he saw at the entranceway was a painting of a Buddha. And he said, what's that? And the curator said, that was painted by Sir Winston Churchill, and it was a painting of a Buddha statue which Sir Winston Churchill had by his bed throughout the Second World War. It's the first time I knew that in England, the Prime Minister during the Second World War, the famous Sir Winston Churchill, had a Buddha statue right next to his bed to give him peace, hope, inspiration during the darkest days of one of the greatest conflicts of our planet. I never knew that before. Why? I've been to many places and found Buddha statues where you'd least expect them. I remember going to a prominent Christian school in Perth. And after giving a talk on Buddhism to the students, the principal invited me to his office for a cup of tea. And on the principal's desk was a Buddha statue. And I said, "What is that doing there? You're a Christian." He said, "Yeah, I'm a Christian." But he said, "It's a symbol of peace for me. Whenever I feel stressed out at work, as you would do as a principal or manager of a top school, I look at that and it gives me peace." Now you understand what a Buddha statue is. Whenever I bow 3 times to a Buddha statue, I don't bow to a piece of metal. I don't bow to a person who lived 2,500 years ago. I bow to what that represents for me. So my first bow, I explain this to Australians. So they say, "What the hell are you bowing for? What are you doing that for? What's the purpose?" And I say, "The first bow, I bow to virtue, to goodness. Because virtue, goodness means so much to me. Every time I've seen people, it's been difficult for them, but they've taken a virtue. It's not the easy decision, the hard decision, which is going to be kind and good to others. That makes the world a beautiful place. People who are honest, who don't tell lies, and they make a promise, they keep it. That's virtue. And I value that so much. When I bow down, it's like I'm raising that above me. I'm valuing it. And the second time I bow to peace. Now, not just peace in the world, but peace in the heart in meditation. Because I found that such an important meaning in my life, peace. And lastly, for the third time, I bow to compassion. Because kindness is what makes the world go round. Kindness is what stops the problems. Kindness is that act which human beings can relate to of all religions, races and genders. It's a beautiful part of being a human being. So I bow down to those three things, because that's for me what a Buddha symbolizes. Virtue, peace and compassion. When I tell that to Westerners, they say, "Yeah, I'm a Christian, but I can bow down to that as well." So have all the people bowing down to a Buddha statue, because they're bowing down to what it represents. Peace, virtue, compassion. That's for me. You can make up your own meaning, what it means to you. That's why Sir Winston Churchill had it by his bedside. He saw it was meaningful. That's why this principal Christian had it by his bedside. He found it gave him sort of strength. So that's why we have these images for what they can give to us. It's not something supernatural. It's what's actually meaningful. So that's... Okay. Go on.
Can we gain enlightenment without meditation?
Enlightenment without meditation. Can you get to Australia without going by an aircraft? You can, but it's really difficult, isn't it? Look, I really recommend, if you come and visit me in Perth, please go by aircraft. Yeah, you can go in the boat, you can go by bicycle and swim the rest of the way, but I would not recommend it. So why do people want to go the hard way? Go the easy way, the Eightfold Pathway. That's the best way to enlightenment. What is meditation anyway? Meditation is learning how to be still, learning how to let go. So if you can't let go, how can you become enlightened? look, do you even know what enlightenment means? This is part of my story. When I was at school, I started getting interested in religion. Because I got these scholarships, I went to a very good school in West London. They had a chaplain, an Anglican Christian. I went to see him one day and asked him, can you please explain to me what God means? I was really interested. This idea of God, what is it? Explain it to me. And he said that God is beyond words. It is the ineffable, the beginning and end of all things, the ground of all being. It is ineffable, ultimate. That made no sense to me. Now, if you really know what it is, you should be able to explain it instead of these gobbledygook words, beginning and end of all things, ground of all beings. I know what the ground I'm sitting on, but what do you mean the ground of all being? So it sounded good, but it was actually nonsense. So later on, I became a Buddhist. And I went to see a monk and said, what is Nibbana? What is enlightenment? And he said to me, enlightenment is ineffable, beyond words. It's the beginning and end of all things. It's the ground of all being. And I said, I've heard that before. You don't know what you're talking about, do you? So it took a long time before someone gave me a really good idea of what enlightenment is, which everybody could understand. So now I'm going to share that with you. This is what enlightenment is. At least you know what it is. Then you may know what you need to get there. So this is the story of the five children playing a wishing game. And a wishing game goes, this is very deep, but so easy to understand. Five children were playing a wishing game. And the rules are this. You have a wish, and the child who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. So the first kid thought for a few minutes and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a new PlayStation, latest version, because he loved playing computer games. Fair enough. The second girl was smarter. She also had more time to think. So she thought, if I had a wish, I would wish for my own video game store. So I could have this PlayStation, all the games, and the next PlayStation which come out, I could have that too. So it's obviously doing better. The third kid, he was really smart. He said, well, I want to win this wishing game. He said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion, US. Because with $100 billion US, he said, I can buy my own video game store. But I could also buy my own school, because the problem is my mummy and daddy say I spend too much time playing computer games and not doing enough time on my homework. If I own my own school, I won't need to do any homework and I can still give myself top grades. And when I graduate from my own school, I can buy my own university, as people do, give myself a PhD, whatever I want, because I own the school. With $100 billion... I'll be able to buy whatever I want, whenever I want it. That's enough for life. So the third kid had the $100 billion US wish. Now, don't think $200 billion is any better, because $100 billion is more money than anyone can ever spend. So the fourth kid had to try and think something better than $100 billion. But this girl was a genius, number four. She managed to think of a wish which was far better than the $100 billion wish. She said with a smile on her face, if I had a wish, my wish would be for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first of the three wishes, I will have the video game store. For the second wish, I'll have $100 billion US, just like the first two. And for my third wish, I will have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. So that was really a very smart answer. She was winning the wishing game. But the last kid managed to think of a wish which was far superior than an infinity of wishes granted. That fifth child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. So content I don't need any more wishes, which surpasses the infinity of wishes. That last kid was describing enlightenment. A Buddha. So content you don't need any more wishes. The fourth kid was describing what most people aspire to in this world. Or maybe let's go to the third kid. Infinite wealth. The fourth kid, infinite power. Whenever you had a wish, it's granted to you. The fifth kid, freedom from desire. There are two types of freedom in this world. Now I taught this to a professor of finance at MIT in Boston, and she told me that in her last class of her PhD students, post-PhD students, she taught this to her students who are all going to work on Wall Street. The two freedoms. The first is the freedom of desire, which is what we aspire to get whatever we want whenever we want it. But the greater than the freedom of desire is the freedom from desire. So content we don't need anything. That's enlightenment. The freedom from desire. I love that story because it just takes you stage by stage into some very profound truths. So now you know what enlightenment is. Freedom from desire. Meditation is a path if you meditate correctly. Meditate is not trying to get something. Ajahn Chah said this time and time again. He said, monks, you don't meditate to attain things. You meditate to let go of things. So if you're trying to get jhanas, stream winning, enlightenment, whatever, that's not meditation. That's more wanting. If you meditate to let go, to be peaceful, to be content, that's meditation. Can you come over here? I'm going to do a demonstration about what meditation is now. The word for meditation in the Chinese Agamas is two characters. I'll probably pronounce it incorrectly. The first one is shu, which means still. And the second is guan, which means looking on, or guan. Guan. Shu Guan. Okay, yeah, I think I'm an Ang Mo, so I'll never be able to pronounce this correctly. Okay, if he was Hokkien, I'd say a Kuai Lo. So, but anyway, you know, stillness is the important part of meditation. Now, I'm now going to hold this cup of water perfectly still. Now, I want you to tell me when it stopped moving. How's it going? Okay, it is still moving, so I've got to try harder. Okay, I'm going to really concentrate now. This is how many people meditate. They never get anywhere. Because you can never hold a cup of water perfectly still. So how do I get this to be perfectly still? Let it go! Wait. Is it still now?
Yes.
Perfectly still. That's how you meditate. If you want to be still, you try to be still, it'll always be moving. You learn how to let it go, leave it alone, then it becomes still all by itself. How to become enlightened. I'm just going on to this subject. I invented the story of the donkey and the carrot. Because, especially in Europe, many years ago, they used to use donkeys to try and pull carts. carrying with people or goods. But about 20, 30 years ago, maybe a bit longer, Buddhism came to Europe and they had to stop using donkeys. Because the donkeys learnt the tricks. Because a donkey is very stubborn. If you hit it with a stick, the donkey won't move. So what you have to do is actually to tie the stick to the donkey's back. So the front of the stick is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you put a string. On the end of the string, you put a carrot. If it was in KK, you put durian. But let's have the carrot. So the donkey sees a carrot 2 foot in front, and because of desire, moves towards the carrot. But of course, the carrot is on the end of a string, on the end of a stick, tied to the donkey's neck. So when the donkey moves forward, so does the stick. And that is how they get the donkeys to pull the carts. They see the carrot, and no matter how much they move towards the carrot always moves away from them. That's just like your life. Happiness, peace, fulfillment, wealth. Sometimes you've been so close to you, you can see it. And you move forward and it goes further away from you. You just can't catch it. And that's just like meditation or enlightenment. Sometimes you can see it, but as soon as you move towards it, it moves away from you. But when Buddhism came to Europe, the donkey learned how to catch the carrot. And this is how it did it. The donkey was running so hard after the carrot, just like you're running so hard after happiness, wealth, fulfillment. He's running so hard after the carrot. But the donkey learned how to let go and stop. So the donkey stopped. And as soon as the donkey stopped, the carrot started moving further away from the donkey. But the donkey had faith. Understood. Soon that carrot was 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Never been that far away before. The donkey do anything? No, it stood perfectly still. And then a strange thing happened. The carrot moved all the way up and started coming back towards the donkey. The first time the carrot had ever been traveling in that direction, ever. Soon the carrot was 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. And it was coming directly towards the mouth. The donkey never needed to do anything. Just at the very right moment, remember to open the door of your mouth to the carrot. And the carrot came straight in. That's how donkeys catch carrots. You've been running after it, you stop, and the carrot goes up and down into the mouth. Smart donkey. That's how you become enlightened. Running after things for too long, you stop. And as soon as you stop, that's called meditation. Still, shue guang, all goes wrong. You go asleep, you go restless. Doesn't matter, let it go. And soon it starts coming towards you. Coming towards you. Thank you. Another arahat. Very good.
Thank you, Achat. For those of you who want to hear more about meditation, Ajahn will be giving a talk on meditation with focus on jhana and no self tomorrow morning, 7:30 a.m. in Pudosul, Yuan Ming Hall. We have limited time. One last question, if there's any, from the floor. I still have some questions. I don't think we have time to go through all of them. So just opportunity for anyone who wants to ask from the floor. Any more questions? Sorry.
Just choose one.
Okay. Do you have a piece of advice for those who are suffering from infertility?
Oh, you're so lucky suffering from infertility. You're not suffering from infertility. You're blessed with infertility. So lucky. Look, it costs a lot of money to have a kid. And you're stuck with it for 20 years or more these days. Even if you commit murder, you're only in jail for 15 years in Australia. 20 years you have to look after this being. It's much cheaper to get a little dog or a cat. And they never cry. They're always there for you. So, oh, you're so lucky. So now look, those people who are fertile, they wish they weren't. Those people who aren't wish they were. My goodness, you have got what's called infertile suffering. Just like the story of these two Thai girls who came for counselling to me some years ago. And I told, they were sisters, and I talked to the older sister first, what's your problem? And she had a husband having a lot of suffering with her husband. You wives, you know the sort of things which you know you have as a husband. And all sorts of stuff she had to deal with. And I was giving her some good advice, but she was having a really hard time with her husband. I was really thinking of getting divorced. No, she had a husband she didn't want, basically. And then I talked to her younger sister, and she was single. She tried to get a partner in life, went out with no boy for a couple of weeks, or maybe the most a month, and then it all fell apart. She's worrying, like, how can I get a proper relationship and find a partner in life? Basically, she was looking for a husband. And suddenly a great idea came into my mind. I said, your elder sister's got a husband she doesn't want. And you want one. Swap. I don't know why they didn't accept that. But then I got serious. I looked at the older sister and said, Madam, you've got what we call husband suffering. Husband dukkha. When you've got a husband, that's what it's like. If you get rid of the husband, you won't have husband suffering anymore. You'll have single woman suffering. It's not the same type of dukkha, it's just another type of dukkha, but it's still suffering. And if you think, okay, I'll become a nun. You won't have single woman suffering anymore, you'll have nun suffering. Just like many of you have been working hard all your life, you've got, you know, going to work suffering. And then you retire. You think, once I retire, then I'll be fine. When you retire, you've got retired person suffering. In life, when you change the situation from one to another, you're just really changing one type of suffering for another type of suffering, that's all. Same with, you've got infertility suffering. If I could make some magic potion and make you fertile, it wouldn't take away the suffering. You won't have infertility suffering, you'll have fertility suffering. You will. You're worried, am I pregnant? Oh my goodness, I haven't had a period for, you know, for 5 weeks. Am I pregnant? Oh my goodness, what am I going to do? So you have different sufferings. So if you're infertile, wonderful, make the best of it. If you're fertile, wonderful, make the best of it. If you're married, make the best of it. If you're single, make the best of it. That's the secret of life, is whatever hand you're dealt in life, make the best of it. And that's why I have found sometimes that you have people with the best ingredients in life, they make a mess of their lives. Sometimes people born with disabilities make a wonderful life. Just like people in the big restaurants in Kota Kinabalu, in the hotels, all the very best ingredients, they don't make as delicious food as you see in the little stalls by the side of the road. Have you ever found that some of the best food you get from poor people were just cooked by the side of the road because they put so much effort and work? Poor ingredients, but my goodness, they can make a good meal. So it's not the ingredients you have which make a delicious lunch, it's how you put them together. So you've lost one ingredient there, you're not fertile, but you can still make a beautiful life. Thank you.
Thank you, Ajahn. Thank you, Ajahn, for a very entertaining and inspiring talk tonight. I'm sure all of us now know how to find the true meaning in our life after listening to Ajahn's talk. Please, can you all join me in saying sadhu 3 times? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Ajahn, please, may you lead us in the sharing of merits now.
Very good. So this is the Ida Bay. Is that how you should do it here? Ida Mayati Nam Hotu? Very good. So this is a sharing of merits to all our deceased relations. Understanding that without them we would not be here today. So any goodness we share with them. Please repeat with me. Ida Mayati Nam Hotu
Sukhita hontu yatayo idam me nyati nang hotu. Sukhita hontu yatayo idam me nyati nang hotu. Sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.